Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. A responsibility revolution is shaking up corporate America. Every one of us, regardless of title or position, can inspire our companies to change the way they do business and help them become a positive force for enriching people, communities, and the environment. Companies that don't participate in this revolution risk becoming obsolete. In his book, Saving the World at Work, Tim Sanders offers concrete suggestions on how all of us can help our companies join the responsibility revolution. Tim Sanders is the author of Love is the Killer App and was the chief solutions officer at Yahoo, Inc. from 2001 to 2005, where he worked on next generation business strategies. Tim, welcome to Edgewise.
Glad to be here, Dave.
In your book, you talk about responsibility revolutions. What are these?
The responsibility revolution is a broad-based movement driven by the market, joined by companies, where the basis of competition is changing from product quality to social quality. It's the biggest revolution in the business world since the quality movement of the 70s and the 80s. And what it means is that companies that make a difference to people, communities, and planet will attract all the top talent, have high productivity, strong brands, and attract the highest quality clients.
Does this revolution impact only individuals, or are we seeing a trend of businesses getting involved as well?
This will impact businesses from public to private. I even believe, Dave, it will impact associations in terms of their ability to attract and retain members over time. What the revolution is driven by is something I call them generation. Them generation is not a certain age like X, Y, Z, or W. Them generation is a context people live in. Them generation folks, usually under 30 or over 60, ask different questions about the products they buy. Instead of saying, what's the price today? They ask questions like, what's the cost over time? They completely change the rules for how they take a job or keep a job over time. I believe that in the war for talent, which will peak around 2015 and be the acid test of success or failure, the winning companies and the winning managers will offer their employees a social compensation plan, not just a financial plan. And what that means is that people that work for responsible companies, whatever, GE, Eco Imagination, down to little Patagonia or Timberland, will take home purpose along with their paycheck.
So let's focus on the five phases of this responsibility revolution. What are they and how do they differentiate?
What we've learned in the research is that every business revolution, and there's really only been a handful in our history, always has five things in common. The first thing that happens in a business revolution is there's a change in the context of life. In other words, there's these exogenic shocks. In the quality revolution, that change was the end of World War II and the affluence that gave people the opportunity to spend money, like the GI Bill. They sampled goods. And what happened was they experimented and they ran into Japanese goods that, thanks to Deming and Juran, were much higher quality than American-made goods. And this is what's happening right now in responsibility. The change in context we have now, not so positive, has been events like September the 11th or Inconvenient Truth or Hurricane Katrina or Enron WorldCom scandals combined with the internet effect of giving people the power to research and make choices. And that's created a change in context, which has also caused people to think different. The second phase is the change of values that comes from this new context. Because when things change, our values change. And from a business standpoint, values are the criteria by which we allocate resources. So the value change that's occurred now in the market is that people spend money and want to increasingly take jobs based on what that company's doing for the world or for the planet or even local communities. In the days of the quality revolution, can I get one change to can I get a defect-free one? But it was the same idea. The third phase of the revolution is what I call the arrival of the innovators. Whenever things change and new values emerge, there's an underserved segment. And very smart, innovative companies, for example, referring to the quality revolution, smart companies, Ricoh, for example, in the copier business, Toyota, Sony, and then eventually here in the United States, companies like Florida Power and Light, or even Motorola, which was a late stage innovator, rush in and they meet the new values. And the incumbents look at it like a dirty business that's too expensive to run and too small to be interested in, allowing these innovators to fly under the radar. in the responsibility revolution, as this has bubbled up over the last few years, the same things happen. It's just a different cast of characters. Consumer products goods companies like Aveda Corporation, which makes eco-friendly shampoo hair care products, joined by apparel companies like Patagonia or Timberland, joined by software companies like SAS Institute or most recently Google, or even joined by giants like Walmart, who, I don't know if you know this, went green in 2005, or even GE with Eco-Imagination, have all changed the way they do business. And as a result, they've taken this multi-billion dollar market. One estimate says it's a $250 billion market of them genders. They've taken this little itty-bitty nascent market and they've built on it. The fourth phase of the revolution is the disruptive phase. The innovators come in, they change the rules of business, they take a small market that explodes when it hits the tipping point, and all of a sudden, the incumbents get toppled by their own hubris. In the case of the quality revolution, the Ford Motors, the Quasars, the Xeroxes of the world said the reason Japanese companies are successful is because the government's subsidizing them. Quality's just a fad. It's too expensive. This, like a bad storm, will pass. And they kept saying it until in 1984, about 400,000 Americans lost their jobs in layoffs, and NBC ran a television special, you might remember, called Quality. If Japan can do it, why can't we? And that's when disruption was complete. In this case of the responsibility revolution, you see disruption in a couple of industries. The most profound area of disruption is in the auto industry, where the big three's taken it on the chin, and for the first time in American history, American company doesn't have market share. In other words, Japan sells more cars to Americans than America sells to Americans. Toyota has become number two. And the reason why is because Toyota revolutionized the idea of community development in terms of how automakers interact with local American communities, the Prius. The Prius was a killer application for them. And what it did, according to researchers, is create a halo effect that all Toyota cars were lean, green automobiles, even the eco-disaster, the Tundra. And as a result, Ford and GM especially got repositioned as old news like the Oldsmobile or the Edsel, and they lost precipitous market share. And what you're seeing right now in Detroit is the first signs of disruption. The fifth phase is what I call the new order. And what that means is at some point, disruption is so profound, the laggards concede, they put the white flag out, just like in the quality revolution when all these Fords and Xeroxes begrudgingly hired Deming and Juran and Crosby to come teach them quality. There's a new world order that emerges. And then it's all about continual improvement, whether it's TQM or Six Sigma. In our case, the new order isn't here yet, except in one industry, the carpet industry, where interfaces changed the rules forever. And right now, every carpet company that wants to be in business has figured out an eco program. But in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see a new world order where from retail to consumer goods to manufacturing and even the military, companies will compete based on their social reputation and not just their differentiation. That's the revolution in a nutshell.
Let's go back to the carpet industry for a minute. How have they changed?
Before Ray Anderson, CEO and co-founder of Interface Corporation, initiated their responsibility revolution internally in 1994, probably 80 to 85% of all carpet ended up in a landfill where it's going to take at least 20,000 years to break down. And when it does, it's going to be a poisonous gas called methane. The average company bought something called broadloom carpet, these huge pieces of carpet that are presumably cut to try to fit rooms. Almost 30% to 40% gets wasted and thrown away as scraps. Ray Anderson, after reading a book given to him by one of his middle managers, had one of those Dickens Scrooge experiences and realized he wasn't a good man, he was a criminal because of what he was doing to the environment. So he adopted a new mission statement called Mission Zero. This is back in 1994. It says we're going to have no effect on the planet by 2020. And he came up with an idea of modular carpet. It's squares, not broadloom. He also came up with the idea of experimenting instead of making carpet out of petroleum, making it out of discarded soda pop bottles. He also came up with the idea of recycling the backing of carpet, one of the most evil parts of what carpet does to the environment. He even changed how carpet was sold and invented retractable leasing programs. So instead of selling carpet to a company, he leased it to them because he knew then he could reclaim it, reuse it, recycle it, or properly dispose of it. He saved $300 million in the first 4 years of the program, but more importantly, he kept about a quarter billion pounds out of the landfill. Why? Because when Interface became popular as the first green company in the carpet business, all the management talent left. Millikan and Niagara and Mohawk as competitors and came to interface like we're seeing now with General Electric. As a result, all their competitors capitulated, and by about 1999, it became a commodity idea in the carpet business that it was modular, low waste, low carbon footprint, and completely recycled. And today, the carpet industry is the only industry in America that complies with the Kyoto Treaty.
You mentioned the them generation. Also in your book, you referred to them as savior soldiers.
Yes.
So who are savior soldiers?
A savior soldier is a person that will use any means necessary to change the world because they have a burning passion to make a difference. They usually had it as a little kid. They might have it from spiritual values. They might have it because of how and where they were raised, but they've got it inside themselves. A savior soldier in my context is a person that figures out a way to use their skills at work to change the world. Whether it's their ability to engineer and innovate, or whether it's their ability to influence other people, especially their boss and their grand boss, that's what I call it, and their great grand boss, to think about making a change. Just like Joyce LaValle, a middle manager, did at Interface with Ray Anderson. She wanted to make a difference because her daughter told her, Ray Anderson needs to hear this message. The carpet industry is killing the planet. So she got this book on the edge of his desk. And as a saver soldier, she used her influence to change the world. In my research, I've met dozens of saver soldiers. But what they all have in common, Dave, is that they found that synergy between good business and great business. That's business where what you do for the planet or the community or your people is so good for the company, if you canceled the program, the company would fall apart. And that's the difference between a pet cause and strategic social responsibility.
You mentioned the community. What specific things could a savior soldier do there?
Local community development is considered by most researchers one of the leading indicators of a socially responsible company to the court of public opinion, to the average Joe Schmo that you're trying to recruit or sell products to. Here's what you can do. Number one, look on your intranet and find a community program. Our research indicates that for companies that have more than 100 employees, there's an 80% chance that there's already a funded community program. There's also a chance, statistically, that less than 1 out of 25 people in your company are involved in that program. And of that 4%, your chief executive officer is involved. Because the CEOs of the world get that this is strategic to their brand and a lot cheaper than advertising. So join it. What we've learned in companies like Timberland or SAS Institute or even what's going on right now at Walmart is there's a tipping point. According to Malcolm Gladwell, it's about 20%. When about 1 out of 5 employees get involved in a community program, it tips. And you look up 2 years later, and in the case of Timberland, 90% get involved, and it becomes the gestalt of the company. In the case of Timberland, what managers have found is that their community service program called Path of Service, you get a week off every year to work for something that you have a passion for, it is the number 2 source of job satisfaction and retention, second only to training and upward mobility. So join something that already exists. But here's the other thing I would say. Find the new cutting edge in business. The new cutting edge in business for the social century is when you, regardless of your rank or title, find that intersection between the community's greatest needs and your company's greatest capability. And when you put the two together, and you create a virtuous circle, meaning the more you help the community, the more the community helps you, you have found the new money machine of the 21st century. UPS figured that out. When they went to Louisville, Kentucky to open their shipping hub, they needed tens of thousands of employees. So they looked around and said, what's the greatest need in Louisville? And what's the greatest detriment to our success there? And it was teen pregnancy and high school dropout rates. They were the worst in Louisville of any part of that region of the country. So when they went there, instead of just advertising or bringing people in from other cities, they created a school-to-work program where any junior or senior in Louisville was guaranteed a job at UPS over the summer or after school. And part of the job, they studied college credit courses and were paid for them. And then the highest quality of those workers were sent for free to university. Today, UPS, I think, is to credit with a dramatic reduction in teen pregnancy, a dramatic acceleration of high school students graduating, and for every open application they have in Louisville, they got 3 qualified candidates ready to fill it. That's an example of companies thinking on the cutting edge. Their CEO, Jim Espy, put it this way, if they do better, we do better. And when you get that, you begin to understand why corporate social responsibility is not just good, it's great. I always think about Dr. Stephen Covey's definition of synergy. Dr. Stephen Covey, a really great thinker, said that synergy is the idea that when you plant two trees close together and the roots commingle, they exist on far less water and grow much taller. And that's the nature of synergy. I believe that companies that are willing to put their roots down in a local community instead of using the local community for minimum wage services, they're going to do better over time. They're going to have the benefit of viral marketing. They're going to have higher quality employees that come from their community. And quite frankly, they're less open to local impediments and roadblocks and regulations. And I think Walmart, for example, has come around to realize that over the last few years.
Tim, what is the true power of being a savior soldier?
There's two things to think about. Let's talk about the functional power. We've interviewed over 300 of the Fortune 500 CEOs, COO, C-level folks. What we tracked was the greatest social innovation at your company, whatever it was, how you went green, how you went community-focused. And we always found out where it came from. And only 1 out of 5 times did it come from a senior executive. The other 4 out of 5 times it came from a middle manager or a frontline employee who found an innovation and learned how to influence the boss, the great-grand boss, and the great-great-grand boss and sell it up furiously. When you learn how to make a difference to people, community, or planet, and then sell that, you become a leader at your organization. I believe the people that will run the company in 2015 or 2020 are more likely to come out of community affairs or volunteer for community affairs than the people that go off and get MBAs over the summer. That's what I've learned, and that's what the research suggests. Coming up with a new product got you promoted in the 80s. Coming up with a new process got you promoted in the 1990s. Figuring out how to give your company purpose will get you promoted, not just in the 2000s, but beyond. But here, finally, Dave, is the second power of being a saver soldier. For decades, a lot of people have suddenly realized that they want to find purpose. That's why Purpose-Driven Life is the biggest selling nonfiction book of our generation. People want meaning, and they want it in their life right now. And they're told they can't have meaning at work, and they've got to leave their values at home and come to work to the no-value zone. When you become a saver soldier, and you create a sustainable program at your company that makes a difference, you have it all. You have meaning, and you have satisfaction. And that's the promise I make to every person who's on the brink of saying, okay, Tim, I'm going to spend some time socially innovating and changing the way we work. Because one of the things I've learned when I've talked to a lot of the leaders of CSR is this. Social responsibility is not how much money you give away. It's how you make your money.
Tim, where can Savior Soldiers find other Savior Soldiers?
I've created a knowledge networking community where Savior Soldiers can find somebody that's in the exact walk of life they are that's already solved their problem. That website is savingtheworld.net. You can write for that blog. You can register and create a profile and be found on that blog, and I hope you join the conversation there.
The title of the book is Saving the World of Work, and the author is Tim Sanders. Tim, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
It would be great to get some feedback, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Your email or phone message might be heard on a future episode. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.